maybe I should invite, you know, we feel uncomfortable if the NCOP is not here.
First, let me take this opportunity to welcome honorable members, minister, finance family, and it's like saying protocol of death when I say finance family. The commissioner for SARS is here. I think that the study is also around, and many others. Minister, this is a very important meeting for us as the committees responsible for finance, both in the NCOP and in the National Assembly. Yesterday, you gave us an opportunity to be in a lock-up session from 10 o'clock until 2 o'clock. I must say, it was for the first time that I stood that long in a lock-up session. But I think it was worth it. And members who attended really conducted themselves in a very professional manner. There was a high level of discipline in your absence, in the absence of the DG, but we had an apology in advance that did not make it. And I understood, and I think all of us understood very well. Making a budget speech, the only time you finalize the budget speech is when you presented it. Up until you read the budget speech, it's still making, it's in the process of being made. Now, having said so, we also want to congratulate you for presenting a budget that so far the comments that we've had are quite positive, very, very positive under a very difficult environment. We would be in a better position as parliamentarians to can add and subtract once we've taken us through this budget today, the detail of it. And members would appreciate that we are not going to rewrite or reread the budget today. We are just going to take us through salient points of the budget. Over to you, Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Chairperson. Thank you very much for your kind remarks, and let me reiterate that this medium-term budget policy statement is indeed, if you like, the first public pronouncement of President Zuma's administration on how it intends to manage, if you like, the rest of this year and the years ahead in terms of the fiscal situation in which we find ourselves. I'll take you, as per your injunction, Chairperson, through a quick presentation which will just refresh your memory and hopefully not bore you too much because you've heard it and read it all before. And then we look forward to the engagement. The Deputy Minister will be joining us shortly. He's at a Cabinet Committee meeting that I'm looking at also. But perhaps before I start, if you don't mind, can I ask the finance family to quickly introduce itself so that you can, if you might not see all of them, you could get an understanding of who they are. So, DG, I'll ask you to lead, and the Commissioner, and then we can go to our other colleagues.
Mr. Dakhanyawan, the Director General of the Treasury.
Opa Mahasula, the Commissioner of SARS.
Kenneth Brown, DDG Intergovernmental Relations in the Treasury.
Sudhir Chandy, Head of Communications in the Treasury. Marissa Fassler, Chief Director of Macroeconomic Management.
Kuben Naidu, the head of the Budget Office in the National Treasury.
Andrew Donaldson, the Public Finance Division in the National Treasury.
Leslie Fisher, Director, Office of the Director General.
So we have a slide presentation, Chairperson, so we'll take you through that. If I can get to the first slide, which essentially makes the point that you all know already, which is that we have an economic crisis. We've also had a change in administration, that our key short-term challenge is to support the recovery, and we've indicated our thoughts on that, and the emphasis on key priorities of government is one that you'll hear repeatedly also. You also heard yesterday that we want to focus and get South Africans focused on a more labor-absorbing economy and to transform and make a lot more effective the delivery of services by the public service. On the next slide, we tell you what the NTBPS covers. I'm not going to read all of that. You're quite familiar with it. The key is to emphasize that this is not a budget. It is a framework within which the budget will be formulated. And it gives some certainty to the other spheres of government in terms of how they can anticipate their revenue. But secondly, as you know, Chairperson, we now have the Money Bills Amendment Act. And as Parliament, you also, I imagine, are looking at how you adapt the way Parliament works and engages with the budget itself. But through the processes within the committee, you will be looking at how actors from outside of Parliament, such as civil society, labor, business, and others, can engage with our thoughts as well. On the next slide, we'll tell you what some of the highlights are. Again, there's a bit of repetition, but labor-absorbing economy and the management of public services. The GDP this year is likely to be -1.9%, next year 1.5%. The fact that there's lower revenue to the extent of about 70 billion rand, which leads to, as a result of our borrowing, a deficit of 7.6% of GDP. But we must emphasize that in the NTBPS, we then also give a clear statement of our intent to bring that deficit down to 4.2% and maybe even lower if economic circumstances allow. So if there's any doubt remaining about our commitment to that as government, we hope that clears it. There's additional spending in the next 3 years to the extent of 78 billion rand. Here, what is important to emphasize is that for the last number of years, we've had real increases in expenditure of about 9%. That comes down to on either side of 1% over the next 3 years. So there is a substantial curtailment of our ambitions, if you like, without compromising our ability to tackle the key priorities. The next slide is the macroeconomic indicators, which will tell us something about how we anticipate, for example, household consumption, which is a key driver in our economy, to perform. So you can see, for example, in 2006, it was 8.3. This year, we estimate it to be -3.1. But you can also see that in the succeeding 3 years, it climbs very slowly. It doesn't just jump back to 8.3%. Similarly, our exports will also take a bit of time to recover, but -19.8% is a significant drop on our side and would have impacted on business in South Africa. Imports, on the other hand, also dropped to -20%. Now, those also increase, but hopefully they don't increase too substantially, because that then begins to affect our current account balance, which you can see right at the bottom, came down from the height of 7.4 to 4.9, and will begin to climb again as the economy grows. We then look at the next slide, on which we look at some of the pluses and minuses, if you like. Why do we say the GDP is what it is? Because we see negative employment dynamics, meaning that employment won't grow as fast as we would like it to. The fact that consumers in South Africa are highly indebted true, they're not as highly indebted as some other parts of the world, but nonetheless they are. And the falling disposable incomes because they're paying off their debt, and perhaps also because they are out of jobs in some instances, or working short time, means that we don't get the same consumption levels, which will enable us to collect more VAT, for example. The impact of the financial crisis on the global economy means people are getting less from goods from South Africa, including commodities. The reduced wealth effects to lower asset prices. I think all of you know how prices in Cape Town in particular and in other parts of South Africa of housing climbed, and they're not doing the same now. So all of those factors have impacted upon the Treasury's consideration of the GDP. Recovery, on the other hand, is supported by what we've been doing through fiscal policy and what the Reserve Bank has been doing through monetary policy. The commodity prices have been fairly stable and they're beginning to rise, and more people are looking at gold, for example, as a form of asset. The investment from the public sector, and in particular state-owned enterprises, has given us that real growth of 17% in investment. And spending related to 2010, and of course spending beyond 2010 is also a key influence in our case. The next few slides will take you through some graphics which will tell essentially the same story: what has happened to growth in the world, in advanced economies, the emerging markets in sub-Saharan Africa, where the grey represents 2009 and whatever the other colour is called, red, maroon, brown, 2010. And you can see how the dips turn to the positive ultimately, and the table next to it indicates what the IMF's forecasts are. The next slide reflects the commodity prices as we indicated, and you can see the drop in 2009, but you can also see a pattern that you will see repeatedly in the next few slides, the uptick, and that's the green shoots that people are beginning to look at, and it means that some of those elements are good for us. What's not good for us is that oil is shooting up, and that might have a negative impact. The slide 9 of the presentation tells us a story about public and private investment in South Africa. The reddish, I can't even work out these colors here, is the electricity, gas and water, and the blackish line is public corporations. And that's in the graph, but if you look at the table itself, general government contribution to investment growth came down from 2007 and it's fairly stable over the next couple of years. Public corporations grew in 2009 but reached a stable level again. Private enterprises came down quite sharply, as you can see, minus 3.6%, but it's anticipated that it will grow again as well. Signs of economic recovery in South Africa. Yesterday you had the publication of what I call the leading indicators, and these have gone up to 6.8% since March 2009, and a number of factors are contributing to this more positive outlook, including the purchasing managers index and the output in those various sectors indicated in the second graph, and the lines that actually accompany that. There's now indications that house prices are increasing. Capital inflows have resumed, the consumer indicators are leveling out, and inflation has fallen marginally as well. We then look at what is supporting the recovery and achieving more rapid growth. The whole issue of jobs will repeat itself continuously, Chairperson, and the question of productivity as well. And the necessity to improve training programs and basic education in South Africa. Promoting faster economic growth with large-scale job creation is something that we've got some experience in as government through the expanded public works programs, but our own view, which cabinet colleagues share, is that we can do better and must do better in terms of doing this on a larger scale. But at the same time, the private sector also needs to come to the party. and do things differently and think about things differently and not get caught up in short-term thinking, to ensure that the young people in South Africa have job opportunities that they badly actually require at this point in time. It's important that we don't burden future generations. Well, let's be frank, that the borrowing that we're engaging in at the moment will burden some parts of the future generation. But the key is, how do we bring the deficit back under control and pay those debts in a way in which we reduce that particular impact? And we reaffirm our prudence in terms of spending, which doesn't tell the full story. I think we need to give the cabinet a lot more credit for the fact that it has taken full cognizance of the fact that we are in crisis, that there isn't plenty full of money, and that we've got to cut our suit according to our cloth, and we'll see a number of manifestations of this. We agree with many role players that long-term interest rates need to be kept low and as a key factor in promoting growth in South Africa. How we achieve that in the contestation with inflation is a challenge that we need to look at. Financial market regulation is a much talked about topic. The Financial Services Board, which is the DG, for example, I think is leaving tonight to go to, I want this for security reasons, I won't tell you where, but overseas, let's put it that way, to attend a meeting of a key subcommittee of the Financial Services Board. So that structure is working at quite a hectic pace, and soon we're going to see a plethora of regulations emerging, which will be for global governance of financial institutions and markets. And that's going to significantly change life. In some respects, South Africa is ahead of the curve, but we can expect a lot more, and if need be, the DG can explain to you what some of those elements are. We continue to encourage foreign direct investment in South Africa, and we'll do whatever necessary, including reducing red tape, to encourage that. And the whole question of leadership, performance standards, and accountability is obviously key. At a time like this, we need to, as South Africans, work harder, work smarter, work more, and demonstrate that we are all prepared to put the shoulder to the wheel to take us out of the crisis that we find ourselves in. This is the consolidated government revenue picture. Tax revenue was close to 28% in 2007-08, and then has fallen to 24.5%. And you'll also see here that it takes a bit of time to get ourselves back even to 26-27%. And this again is an indicator that the economy is going to grow, but it's going to grow slowly, unless we also undertake some fundamental restructuring in our own economy. And you can, I'm sure you've gone through the other figures during your sojourn yesterday. The government fiscal framework, we've explained the budget deficit to you and why we thought it's necessary to borrow to the extent that we are, and why that deficit is a manageable deficit. The recovery in the budget balance will be driven by revenue improvements with growth, but also revenue improvements with better compliance than we have. A decline in SACU transfer payments, which has a serious impact on SACU countries, but unfortunately the unavoidable outcome of the fact that the imports have declined. And a stabilization in non-interest spending. The numbers are there before you, Chair, and hopefully we can engage on them later. What does the impact of the borrowing on interest costs? That's the grey graph. And you can see we brought it down quite significantly, but it's on the up again over the next few years. Put under control. But you've heard the story many times before that those levels are not sustainable, and that we need to bring them down again in order that we have more resources available for service delivery. The red line indicates the deficit of the budget balance, and you can see that coming down to almost 8%, but then working its way gradually upwards as we've committed. So fiscal sustainability, you'll see on the next graph, the red line is the revenue and the black line is the non-interest spending. And the gap between the two grows to a significant distance, if you like, next year. And we then begin to narrow it down in the following years. And the trick is whether we can get those two lines to meet again. The next slide tells you about our net loan book outlook. And again, you can see the graphs going up and down, indicating that our borrowing is going up, as we have stated to you already. Public sector infrastructure spending. As in the past, we are committed to this area. Over the next 3 years, 872 billion rand will be spent on infrastructure. And there's a whole list of projects that are already on our books. And these numbers spell out how we see that happening over a period of time. There's a repeat of the public sector borrowing picture by general government in grey and the non-financial public enterprises in red, also indicating the higher levels of borrowing, but at a sustainable level nonetheless. You've read and heard about the changes to exchange controls, which the next slide looks at. I'm not going to go into the details. We can discuss that later. And then spending priorities over the medium term is what the next slide looks at, which essentially supports the five key programs that government wants to give focus to. And as we do the budgeting for next year, you'll begin to see the numbers that go with each of those priorities. We've emphasized both to you and to South Africans more generally that apart from raising revenue and borrowing, we also need to find savings from within the government system. We've distributed a book, or booklet as a preliminary report from three ministers, Ministers Baloyi, Chabane and myself, which sets out our approach to the savings question. And in time, the presidency will lead a comprehensive expenditure review process, which I'm sure Parliament will be involved in as well. And that will give us more insight into what is, if you like, below the baseline. And what are some of the things that we can actually change. We've talked to you already, so I'm not going to go and explain that at length, but the procurement system in South Africa needs a serious review, and we have teams working on that as well. One of the key outcomes of the MTEF is the division of revenue, and this is the picture, 36% to national government, and the reasons are there, 51% to provincial government. Let's remind ourselves that it's provincial government that delivers most of the key services that our people receive in respect of education and health and housing, and 13% to local government. And we must concede here that local government is a part of local government, or some municipalities are in dire straits. And together with our colleagues in COCTA, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, we're looking at some formulae to actually assist them. The key funding items going ahead, as we indicated in the speech and in the documentation yesterday, is employment creation through public works programs, the investment in education, particularly the assistance we are giving to schools, the handbooks that we are developing, additional resources for science laboratories, textbooks and training of teachers, all of which will hopefully get our education system onto a new footing. Similarly, there's a huge commitment by government to getting our health system ready for the national health insurance process. And what is crucial here is to ensure that the infrastructure works. So the hospital revitalization program is crucial, that we are able to address the needs of AIDS treatment as it is actually growing. And you know that some 5 billion rands are set aside for the next 3 years and 900 million rands in the current period. Mass vaccination campaigns to reduce incidence of measles. And all of these, amongst others, will lay the foundation for the implementation of Minister Motsoaledi's 10-point plan. and the introduction of the National Health Insurance System. There's no numbers at this stage because those are still being worked upon. On the next slide, we look at the Comprehensive Rural Development Strategy. Again, you're familiar with this, fighting crime and addressing the built environment. So thank you, Chair. That's just an outline to put you off to sleep so that there won't be too many questions following. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Deputy Minister, welcome. You want to ask questions? Okay, thanks, Minister. Honorable members, I think the presentation is simplified and direct, but let's engage with Dr. Dion. Good enough, you'll follow in a brief.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Minister, for your presentation. Minister, you said some very good things about rooting out corruption and managing wasteful expenditure. It is probably easier said than done in the real world. What concrete steps are you planning to take to implement this in practice? And also in terms of the state-owned enterprises, you also mentioned in the booklet that expenditure on these entities needs to be managed. How in particular are you going to do that? And then you mentioned the size of the public sector wage bill, that it's on the way up, and that if this trend continues, you'd have to increase taxation or cut expenditure where you can to accommodate this trend. What measures are going to be taken to manage the size of the public sector wage bill, and are you planning to increase taxation? And then on the borrowing, the government plans to borrow 285 billion rand. Where are you going to borrow this money? Because there are implications if you do it in the domestic market. It does do various things to the access to domestic credit in the domestic credit market. And then also on the international markets, there's obviously the price, and then there's the currency risk if the rand depreciates. And then you mentioned about plans for the Treasury and the Reserve Bank to support low inflation and a more stable and competitive real exchange rate. Are you planning to take steps to intervene to devalue the currency? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, just to congratulate the Minister on his performance yesterday. You remember in the budget vote I said, I gave him a quote of Madiba, when you've got a good head and a good heart, it's always a formidable combination. And I think he proved me right yesterday. Can I ask, you know, on the one slide, the income estimate... I beg your pardon? Okay. The income estimate for 2010-2011, I think the figure is 743 billion, but it's 13% higher, almost 12%, you know, if you take the custom transfer into consideration, it's probably 12%, 11.8% higher than the previous year. What I would like to know is whether that is a optimistic estimate or a conservative estimate. Why I'm asking that is, if you look at your inflation target of 6.4 and your growth rate, you expect to be around about 2%. If you add it together, your nominal GNP growth rate will be just over 8%. Now, that 13-12% estimate growth, it becomes important that you achieve that, and if you are over optimistic, then obviously taxes will come into play at that time. Then finally, on the savings task team booklet we've seen yesterday, they've mentioned
to know that they're going to revise the ministerial handbook. When can we expect that?
Thank you.
Honorable Sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. And maybe also from our side, congratulate you, Minister, on your baptism of fire, as they said yesterday in the media. We were all suitably impressed. And I wonder how many of us looked at the figures for government expenditure for 2012-2013, where we went past the 1,000 billion mark, and that is quite a remarkable figure, 105.28. Chairperson, and thank you, Minister, for basically confirming our macroeconomic policies, bringing down the deficit, keeping inflation and the interest rates low. I'd like to just touch on your perspective of economic growth. 1.5%, would you say is that conservative? We obviously welcome that and see the green shoots, and we notice it's also similar to the USA growth of 1.5%. And then also the issue of, in view of the high deficit, whether you foresee in the longer term a need to increase taxation. There is a reference on page 13 where you speak about other means of increasing revenue, such as broadening the tax base, improving tax compliance, and introducing new taxes such as environmental levies may have to be considered. Would you consider any other, such as individual corporate taxation increases? Chairperson, then just on the issue of the land bank, the 1 billion, you were very keen to explain the need to address corruption and to address wastages, and we appreciate the recapitalization of the land bank, but it seems that it's taken a long time to address the issues of recovering funds with officials involved in the land bank. And how do you see us going ahead with using the special investigating unit or some? Those forensic reports have been out for a long time. What has been done to urgently address recovery of funds there and bringing those officials to book? Thank you very much, Chairperson, for that.
Thank you, Chair. On page 22 of your presentation this morning, you referred to the $78 billion available for allocation to key government priorities, and you say in there that 13% of that goes to local government. But in your document of yesterday on page 49, you said 16% goes to local government. So I just want to make sure whether it's 16 or 13%, although on page 22, if you add those figures, you come to 100%. So I don't know whether you're using a bit of Chinese bookkeeping here, but I'd just like to know which one is correct.
Honorable Liange. Thank you, Chair. Let me also voice my shared sentiment in relation to the job well done that has been done by Treasurer yesterday. The issue that I would want to get maybe more emphasis from Treasurer is in relation to the envisaged savings as well as improvement of spending patterns, especially on health and education. If maybe there can be a clear mechanism to put forward exactly the areas within which the savings are going to be made in a particular department, it must be explicitly spelled as to which line function is going to be affected, so as to ensure that there are no savings on savings, because the administrative bureaucrats in the name of laxity would want to understand and relate that to savings. So savings cannot be made on savings. Savings will be identified, and the budget that is going to come forth will be inclusive of that. There is no further savings that should be done in the name of understanding. Maybe is there any mechanism that Treasury is going to ensure that the savings, the areas within which savings are going to be made, are clearly spelled out, and there is a clear mechanism to ensure that the spending patterns in relation to provinces is going to be improved and monitored. Thank you.
It was.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also congratulate the Minister on his balanced policy statement yesterday. My first question, Chairperson, is on inflation targeting. I just want to get from the Minister if he thinks this is the best option. Let me use both of them. I want to check from the Minister, Chairperson, if he thinks that inflation targeting is the best option for South Africa. Especially because in the recent past, our inflation has always been outside the band that has been agreed to by the cabinet. My second question, Chairperson, is on the issue of a matriculant voucher. I don't understand how that problem is going to work. If I can get a more explanation on that voucher, as opposed to the call for free education. The third question is on skills development. I see that there's a new proposal on how to deal with this skills shortage in the country. And my understanding is that year after year, this government has developed so many strategies to deal with the issue of skill shortages, but we have never been presented with the output of those strategies. There's GISA that has been established recently, and it had its own targets in terms of the skills development in the country, but we don't know how far have they gone and what has been the challenges in terms of responding to the challenge of skills shortage. If the Minister has that report, I'll be happy if he can share that with us. On SACU, Chairperson, I want to relate to this with the interim economic partnership agreements, and I hope today I'm not going to be referred to the Department of Trade and Industry. I understand that South Africa has not signed the EPAS, and some of the countries in the region have signed the EPAS, and that is causing conflict between South Africa and the members of SACU. What I want to get from the ministry is that because of the reduced revenue from the SACU and the proposal to review the formula, is this decision of these countries to sign EPAS informed by those processes? Because they might be aware that after the reviewers and so on, they might get a cut in terms of the slice that they have been getting in the past. So I just want to check if their decision is informed by those processes. The last one, Chairperson, is on Triple P, as presented, that maybe it can be employed as one of the strategies to deal with the current economic situation in the country. I again want to check from the presenters if the Triple P route is the best option under current economic crisis. This will be the conventional way of doing things this government. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Mayor.
Thank you, Chair, and the co-chair. I'm so sorry, Honourable Minister, they say we're going to ask you more questions, and I don't think they're expecting them. I would like to first start by maybe reminding ourselves that if I do understand the documentation that was given to us yesterday, it indicates to two key policy issues. transformation of the economy so as to enable massive expansion of employment. 2, changing a culture towards responsibility and accountability in the public service. Now, based on that, then as an ANC member, then it says to me, how much of the NTDPF presentation done by the department has addressed the manifesto program indeed it did. If you look at it, it did highlight quite a number of things. But there are a few issues that have got a bit of a concern. So if you can allow me, Honourable Chair and the co-chairs, because I've got three documents that I will reflect on. The first one is this one, which was the yesterday one. On page 9 of this document, the minister and the department, they refer to the counter-cyclical fiscal policy. It warrants. I understand the meaning, but I'm just asking myself, how is it going to contribute towards the developmental space and the mixed economy? If the minister can explain that. On the same page, bullet number 2 on top, the minister and the department are proposing that the income tax. The government needs to consider utilizing the income tax to provide incentives to the employers to hire the staff. Is there a program in place? How is it going to be utilized? Exactly how is it going to be, on which project is this incentive going to be channeled to, and how is it going to be monitored? I'm done with this one. With this assessment application draft, Comrades, Honourable Chair and the Co-Chairs, the page 4 and 5, Schedule 1 and Schedule 5, I'm not too sure if we are where we are as far as the financial environment. Looking at what you see here, the priorities that have been forwarded by each department, is it not possible to actually zoom in? We know that the manifest has got those 5 key deliverables, but within the 5 key deliverables, there will be sub-deliverables. Now, how possible it is to know exactly that the health, its main core priorities are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The education, its main core priorities are so as to ensure that there is the balancing of the priorities and the budget. Because that's exactly what the money bill will need or expect from the parliamentarians to do. So that will enable the parliamentarians to be able to assess the implementation of the budget towards the priorities set by each department. Now, coming to the today's presentation, page 6, the macroeconomic forecast. The growth is appreciated as put into this paper from 1.5% to 3.2%, that's a projected one. Now, I will request the minister and the department that whatever factors that they were used to arrive to those estimations to be adhered to be reviewed now and again, because they might not work, and then at the end of the day, come 2012, we don't reach the 3.2. Because I am assuming that some factors guiding the economic growth were used to arrive at that 3.2% estimated projected growth. Secondly, there is no way the document talks about the SMME. And I strongly believe that a developmental state will never develop its economy without involving a program, a financial program of the FMLA. Somewhere in the document, the minister and the department talks about the bankers making sure that they assist the investors, but nowhere where you get a feeling of how the SMM is, because we have seen this 15 years where the SMM is, they're not really assisted towards the growth. I'm not going to talk about the training because it has been covered by other members. If you go to the next page, which is slide number 7, Global Growth Outlook. Yes, it's true, we do need some relationship with other countries so as to grow our economy. It says the fiscal and monetary expansion growth, and then it affects China and India. Now, how is this going to contribute? I don't get it. This fiscal and monetary expansion, if the China and the India, they come to South Africa, do they also take on board our emerging contractors? If so, where is the program in place? How are we going to monitor that as the parliament? That yes, there is a program. Indeed, the Chinese, they came with this project and our country put so much on board to assist our emerging contractors to grow, because if you don't assist them to grow, even our own private sector, we are not going to be nowhere, because at the end of the day, when you do the borrowing, it's far better to borrow within than to go outside. I'm almost done, as Chair. Almost. Slide 19, Chair and the Co-Chair. Honourable Minister, the slide 19, bullet number 3 and 4. Can you explain it further for me? Because I really do not understand. And also give us the monitoring tool for the SDI for the reason for increasing from 50 million to 500 million.
Thank you, Honorable Tamini. I know there are some hands that have identified. I thought it would be only fair to allow the minister and his team to respond or just to give clarity on the questions that have been raised before we take the next round of questions and comments. Over to you, Minister, and your team.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks to the honourable members for their questions. Yeah, the team will now be on its toes, so we can pass the ball to them. Dr. George talked about corruption and savings, and that words are easy, and what are the concrete steps? Fortunately, I come from a background where we don't disengage in words. We've achieved some of these things. But we have some idea of what needs to be done, and these are not just words. But far more important is how do all the members of this committee and the interests that they represent share our common commitment to removing corruption? What do all South African leaders do in order to spread the same message, and rather than turn it into a political football? Because if you turn it into a political football, we discredit it. So, under your guidance, Chair, what I would like to ask that we promote is a consensus on this issue, not a division on this issue, that we are all committed to this, that we want a common set of values, whichever political party we come from, and that we will fight this cancer together, and not just to score political points. Because if we're scoring political points, we shoot ourselves in the foot, ultimately, Because why are we busy scoring points? Those who are engaging in corruption continue. Now, what have we done? We've set up a task team of about 6 or 7 agencies some 2 months ago. They've been meeting on a weekly basis. They've been looking at individual cases of tender fraud. They've been looking at the supply chain system as a whole to identify where there are weaknesses in that system, which leads to some of these issues. And I hope in the next few weeks we'll get a concrete sense of direction in terms of what we do. But no one step is going to solve this problem. This is a culture issue, ultimately. And if we don't root out the culture of corruption, the culture of what I call pickpocketing the state, then we won't be able to succeed at all. So we'll get the specific instances, we'll make some examples of some of the individuals concerned, but let's commit, as all of the political parties, to fighting the wrong culture and promoting the right culture. The same applies to savings as well. A number of members have asked about the savings. Mr. Kornoth has asked about the ministerial handbook. My colleagues, Ministers Deutsch and Baloy, will be having a press conference, I think, today, where they will address that particular issue. So I'm not going to anticipate what they're saying, but what we indicate in the booklet is that that is receiving attention. But coming back to Dr. George's question on saving, the same process. Nobody thought that we could do it, but we, again, worked over the last 6 to 8 weeks. We've found billions of rands already. That process will continue. But apart from the rands and cents that we find, it's the culture and the mindset that we're talking about. Is the mindset a spendthrift one? Is the mindset one which says we can be lavish with public money? Or is the mindset which says we need to manage this in a discreet and proper way? And again, I think if we can send out a common political message and not make this a political football again, it would help to ensure that all of us work together in order to get the right mindset in the public service, but importantly, the right mindset in the private sector as well. Because when we come to the supply chain issues, it's not the public service buying from itself with one or two exceptions. It's the business sector that sells goods to the state. It's the business sector that benefits from the billions of rands that the state actually spends. Now, where is this conversation in the business sector? About what it will do, about what kind of values and norms it will promote, about how it will do its part in order to complement that which government is doing. And when you make this again a political football, it's easy. You just point to the government and the public servants, and they're the nasty and lousy ones, forgive the language. This is a social problem, and it's one that plagues many societies, not just ours. But let's agree that as far as cabinet is concerned, we want savings, we want value for money, we don't want the state exploited in any way, we want the services that we actually say we're tendering for. If you're supposed to build a school, build it, and build it properly. And don't let it cost 30 million in one province and 18 million in another province. So we'll get there, Dr. George, I can assure you. It won't be easy. But if we have consensus in places like this room, then it makes it easier to actually get there. Otherwise, we create irrelevant divergences around us. State-owned expenditure, the message is the same. Get your act together. We're not here as government's nickname isn't bailout agency. And so we're not here to compensate for the mismanagement that we see in some of the enterprises. There are the enterprises that are well managed. So again, we mustn't paint all of them with the same brush. Let's distinguish where there is good management systems, there are good approaches to managing and providing leadership. We must complement it, we must reinforce it, we must acknowledge it. And where there is blatantly mismanagement, like the SABC, then we must move in. And we must compliment Minister Nyanda for being quite decisive in intervening and setting up the task team. Within the next 2 or 3 days, you'll see further steps that both his department and the Treasury will be taking to get that right. From a Treasury point of view, we are insisting with colleagues, and they are cooperating with us, that we will do tougher things than we've normally done to ensure that some of these issues are actually tackled in the right way. On the public sector wage bill and the size of the wage bill, we would agree with you that we've got to keep a balance, like all things in life, between what we pay in respect of the wage bill and what we extend in terms of infrastructure investment and other expenditure on the part of government. So as we go forward over the next few years, we'll certainly keep a watchful eye on that and see how we balance it out. But also, the same value for money principle applies, that if we spend X amount of money, then we want X amount of value out of it as well. And my colleague Minister Baloyi will be looking at this area to see how we provide some guidelines in terms of how further expenditure takes place in respect of hiring in the public service. So for example, we want less people sitting behind desks in administration positions, except where required and appropriate. We want more people hired in the front line, police for the police service, nurses for the health service, doctors for the health service, educators for the education system. And the bias needs to be towards the service delivery side as opposed to the administrative side. Several of you have raised the taxation issue. There's no immediate decision to raise taxation. All we're saying is that in the spirit of transparency and openness, the rest of the world is also looking at this issue. So if we aren't able to manage our finances, if we don't see the economy progressing as we think it will progress, that could be an eventuality. We don't know whether it is going to be at this point in time. If we change our minds, you'll know, I think it's on the 17th of February, at 6 in the morning, in your case. The borrowing question, I'm going to ask the Director General to come in and address that. And he can also address the issue of National Treasury and SARB in terms of the exchange rate and in the devaluation of the currency. Mr. Zemiako.
Thank you, Minister. Let's start with the issue of the public sector borrowing requirement. You'd be aware that the figure you had referred to of 284 is a consolidated figure. It includes the state-owned enterprises. We would share your views with respect to potential pressure that it would put in domestic capital markets. But the domestic capital markets have been able to absorb these figures relatively easily. It's been a combination of factors. The first factor had to do with the fact that we had foreigners returning to our domestic markets, that our domestic bond yields are still attractive relative to bond yields elsewhere. So we had attracted the flow. But it is also for that reason that we are concerned that you see that we are winding down the deficit over the next 3 years, because you can't continue at that level infinitely. So what's important is the credible path of ratios of fiscal sustainability over the next 3 years. And that is what this budget policy statement is doing, saying that yes, we have had a big gap this year. For this year, there was nothing we could do. We filled it up with borrowing. But over the next 3 years, we are going to have to run a tight ship in order to return to more comfortable fiscal position. With respect to the exchange rate, you know, South Africans, we get really obsessed with this. When in 2001, the currency depreciated big time to some 13.85, as South Africans, we got so upset that we even called for a commission of inquiry Because we believe that there were some group of people in a dark place somewhere in Europe or in the US who are engaged in a conspiracy to bring our country down. So we needed to find these people. Okay? And when the currency is strong, we bang our heads again. We complain that the currency is very strong. One fellow asked, they are yet to meet a chief executive of a company who complained that their share price is too strong. If only it was that simple. The exchange rate is a very important price in the economy. The issue here is, as a country, we said that we would like to have a stable and competitive exchange rate. And it's a subject that is seldom understood, because what all of us do is to look at the daily movement of the exchange rate. The spot rate, as we see, is quoted in the daily newspapers or in radio or in the wires on a daily basis. That is not what a stable and competitive exchange rate is. A stable and competitive exchange rate would necessarily take into account the inflation differentials between South Africa and its major trading partners. In technical terms, it is the real effective exchange rate that makes us competitive, not the daily gyrations that we see in the market. Well, if we do not like an appreciating currency, what policy choices do we have? We can go and buy the foreign exchange so that we influence the nominal exchange rate, and by so doing feed that into the real effective exchange rate, and that would entail us having to have significant resources to do that. In the past 2 years, we were able to do that because we ran a budget surplus, so we used the surplus to go and buy the reserve. At the moment, we have a deficit. So for us to go and intervene in the currency would mean that we must issue bonds in order to go and buy the reserve. So basically, increase the debt in order to acquire the reserve. That is one choice that is amazing. The second choice that nobody wants to talk about is that a rising inflation appreciates your currency. It doesn't depreciate your currency. So when people say, let inflation run, it's okay, they are actually calling for an appreciation of the currency. Interestingly, it's the same voices that actually would say, depreciate the currency. But they are calling for something that would actually not depreciate the currency, but would actually appreciate the currency. So if you want to have a stable and competitive exchange rate, you are going to have to keep inflation low relative to that of your partners. Not high, because if it is higher than that of your partners, you are appreciating the currency, you are not depreciating it.
That's what you call a wake up call. Thank you, Didi. So that deals with income to Mr. Kornoff. Thank you for your complimentary remarks, and we'll try to live up to that. Whether our income estimates are optimistic, yes, they are. So let's live up to the optimism. And I'll give the Commissioner an opportunity in a moment to explain what SARS is and will be doing in order to ensure that we optimize our revenue. And also what the world is doing. I think there's some fascinating things happening. There's a conference in Beijing over the last few days where global representatives of tax administrations are meeting. So there's a sharing of ideas and methodologies that is happening now on a global scale to ask where do governments get their resources from, and who are the people and what techniques are people using to evade taxes. He can talk about that as well. Perhaps you want to do it now, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thanks, Minister, and thanks to the chair. From the perspective of broadening the tax base, there are a few things that we're doing. You know, broadening the tax base means getting into the tax base, all those people that are outside the tax base, or all the income that is not captured in the fiscus. And one of those types of incomes is undeclared income. Through our robust third-party system that we have built, we've managed to do verification. Like, for example, if you submit your return and you have not declared your interest income, that's an example. Because we get information and we verify, we exchange information with banks and other financial institutions, we are able now, we are at a point now in terms of our modernization processes to accurately be able to say you have not declared certain interest or accounts and investments that you are holding for certain financial institutions. We were not at this point about 2 years ago because we didn't have the databases and the algorithms that we have been building in the last 3 years. So now for those people that under-declare or don't declare, we're now in a position where we can be able to find the money that we're trying to hide from us. Under declaration, the same thing as I said, and then unregistered taxpayers. Just by the way, on the undeclared income, we started about 2 years ago, if you remember, honorable members, we started what we called employer filing season. Through that process, which ended in May for this filing season, we identified about 4,000 employers who deducted pay as you earn from their employees and never handed it over to the fiscus. It's a criminal offense, obviously, and we have issued summons to make sure that, you know, we get that money into the fiscus. And then in the same manner, because employers then hand over the IRP files of their employees that they employ, we identified about 680,000 people that were supposed to be registered for tax but were not registered for tax, who are above the threshold for registration. And then on the avoidance and evasion side, we are now members of the steering committee on the Global Forum on Transparency and Information Sharing, where we would be able to be for the first time in a position where we will know about investments and other schemes that people are holding outside the country. And as members of the OECD, African Tax Administration Forum, we also sign a lot of information sharing and transparency agreements with tax havens. We've had about four with Cayman Islands, Mauritius, and a few other tax havens that has been facilitated through the G20. And with that, we started now to have a lot of information about people that have swept enough money out of our country and avoided tax illegally. So that's what we're doing from an enforcement point of view. We also, as the minister mentioned in his speech, that we have now implemented a much more effective administrative penalties regime, which we believe will help to bring into book all those outstanding returns. There are about 3 million of them, which does not necessarily mean that there are 3 million people that owe us returns. You know, it could be multiple, one person owing us multiple returns. So with that, we have seen volumes actually increase. We've had tax practitioners telling us that they are seeing unprecedented volumes. So it means, at least in the beginning, the new penalty regime seems to be helping to broaden the tax base. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Swart, economic growth, Ms. Kassler will address that.
Thank you, Minister. If I may, I might combine the question also from the honourable member on the assumptions and the how our model works. Within the Treasury, we have a very rigorous forecasting process. We have our own macroeconomic model that is constantly being fine-tuned and benchmarked against other institutions' models, for example, the Bureau for Economic Research. So even though we only get two opportunities during the year to publish forecasts during the budget and the NTDBS, we're constantly throughout the year working or fine-tuning our assumptions that feed into the model. We have to make a wide range of assumptions in order to get to the final forecast. And that includes an assessment of what the global economy is going to do, particularly forecasts for major G7 economies, the US, the UK, Japan, China, etc. Commodity prices are a very important component in our model, so we project what we think is going to happen for the next 3 years. We use a wide range of inputs from different banks, institutions like the IMF, etc., to inform our forecasts. And exchange rate, the US dollar, where that's going to go. So it really is a very comprehensive set of assumptions that underlies the final outcome. And since we only get two opportunities during the year to publish the forecast, we need to, we do spend a lot of time trying to make sure that what we do eventually publish is reasonable. Relative to consensus, our forecast for 2010 is a bit low. It's about half a percentage point lower than the Reuters consensus forecast. But having said that, the Reuters survey, which is one of the consensus surveys, has a very large range of forecasts for next year, which reflects a high degree of uncertainty that is still out there. For example, the forecast range from half a percent only 0.5% growth to 3% growth. So, economists definitely are divided on how quickly the recovery is going to sort of take place next year. So we're situated somewhere in the middle. I think it's a proven forecast. I wouldn't necessarily call it conservative, but it certainly, I think, is reflected of the economic times, and particularly the fact that we are concerned about employment dynamics, about the fact that households are still quite indebted. Credit extension is taking a while to pick up. So there are green shoots, but those are taking time to feed through. And we would rather err on the side of caution right now than becoming over-optimistic, because for most of this year we've been criticized for having a too high forecast. And particularly also on the global environment, we are slightly less optimistic than the IMF, because we are concerned about what happens once the effects of fiscal stimulus and the stimulus measures start to fade. But hopefully, by the time of the budget next year, things will be looking better. And obviously, if we could revise them upwards at that point, it would be preferable rather than having to revise them lower.
In other words, we'd love to be proven wrong. On the land bank, I can assure you that this situation is under control. That the new CEO, Mr. Hadebe, is on top of all of the demands of the land bank. Secondly, we are going to reorientate the land bank and ensure that Minister Stuma Chetterson and Minister Nkwenti and ourselves are involved in that process, so that we begin to feed more accurately into, or more appropriately into, the rural development strategy of government, so that we promote and give support to small farmers, that we create jobs within the agricultural sector in the rural areas, and so on. So that reorientation will happen in the course of the next few months, and we've commenced the process to actually do that. Secondly, we've set up what I would call a joint mandate committee. It's not in law, we're doing it voluntarily, where the three ministers will sit together. So although I have the statutory responsibility for the land bank, I invite the other two ministers to participate in shaping that mandate, because it's what the land bank does that is relevant to their function. And that's the spirit, if you like, of Chapter 3 of the Constitution, cooperative governance. The third thing is that there is, and it's rather unfortunate that we keep raising questions, and I don't blame you for that, but in an inappropriate way, as if the land bank is hiding something or somebody else is hiding something. I mean, we're all aware of how criminal justice processes work. If I have a suspicion that something is happening, I report it to the police. The police then start an investigation process. If they think they've found enough evidence, they go to the prosecution. If the prosecution thinks that this is a prosecutable case, they go to court. That's the process we've got to wait for. I share completely your impatience that this is taking too long. I've intervened once and intend to intervene again to ensure that something begins to happen in terms of bringing people who've really stolen from the state, in our view, brought to book. And that's that SOE issue that I talked about earlier on as well. And again, even if you've heard it before, let me say it to you again, we will not tolerate that kind of behavior, and those people must be dealt with. But we are not judge, jury, prosecution all in one. We merely have a statutory mandate for the land bank, and then we hand over. But I'm sure that people who operate in the criminal justice system will understand this and hopefully respond in the appropriate way. Let me shift to the other Mr. Swart. You know what they say, mea culpa, you're right, we're wrong. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when there's this late night effort to put a slide together, the finger went to the 3 instead of the 6. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. Mr. Naidu will address some of the questions from some of the other honourable members, and I'll come back again to some of them.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Chair. Let me start off with the question on savings and underspending. I assure you that we're not going to be calling underspending savings. The process that has been led by the three ministers is that we take the spending plans for the next 3 years of government and we see what we can cut out of those spending plans without compromising service delivery. So we've reduced administrative spending, we've reduced spending that was budgeted for conferences or venues, sometimes call costs, sometimes travel, hotel accommodation, all of those kinds of things. For example, if we've seen a sharp increase in the travel of a department from, for example, 50 million rand in 1 year to 80 million in the next year, we'll take some of that away. And so the savings exercise, and as the ministers pointed out, this is just the first cut. It's just the first step in trying to reduce inefficiency and wastage in government. But we assure you that we won't be calling money that is not spent by government department savings. That would be dishonest. And let me deal with the two issues raised by the honourable member about the vouchers for matriculants and considering using the income tax system to incentivize employers to hire staff. These are proposals. They're not yet in place. The Minister and the government and President Zuma challenged us to put some ideas on the table on the kinds of things that we think can grow employment. And these are two ideas. They're not our ideas. They're not new ideas. They've been on the table for some time. But we put them forward as possible options to address the unemployment issue. The way in which the voucher for school leavers would work is a school leaver would get a voucher that they could either use to access a training opportunity, or they could present it to an employer that would help subsidize the cost of employing that person. So it would lower the costs to an employer without lowering the wage to the matriculant. So there isn't any attempt to deviate from government's no-fee schools policy or for government's attempts to try and continuously both lower the cost of further and higher education, but also to subsidize the poor for further and higher education. It's an idea that was presented by the International Growth Advisory Panel. South Africa's most critical problem in the labor market is the school-to-work transition. Too many people leave school and can't get jobs, and this is one idea to try to smooth that school to work transition voucher. And similarly, the income tax system is used to incentivize several things. We give depreciation allowances. We use the tax. We have a tax incentive for the film industry. Why not have a tax incentive to get people to hire staff, especially school leavers, especially first-time work seekers? We're exploring those kinds of ways. It's a tax incentive that could go to an employer to hire people who have a particular level of skills or people straight out of school. It has the advantage that it will not lower the wage of the person, but it will lower the cost to the employer. So it's a tax break to employ people. And these are not formal proposals that we've presented. I guess the ideas that we are contributing to the debate on what to do about our high unemployment rate. On your proposals to change the presentation of the adjustments budget to more clearly indicate what government's priorities are, we will take those considerations into account, and we welcome those considerations. One more question I'll deal with is, how does the fiscal and monetary expansion in India and China support our recovery? Most of the fiscal and monetary expansion in India and China are going into infrastructure projects. Infrastructure projects in turn demand commodities, and therefore we can export to those countries. So, for example, India's investment in its rail system, in their own power generation capacity, is increasing demand for our coal exports. China's infrastructure program is increasing demand for steel and iron ore products that we export. And so we are benefiting from the fiscal expansions in those countries. It will contribute towards our recovery. Thank you, Minister. Thanks.
Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Minister. The first one I will look at is the question in relation to inflation targeting, whether this is the best option. And Honourable Member goes on to say, since we have continuously missed the target. As Honourable Members would know, that government took a decision a few years ago to introduce inflation targeting as an anchor of monetary policy. As such, we would also appreciate that managing inflation is also more about expectations, and therefore it becomes critical that there is this kind. And we, as indicated even in the Minister's speech, we are committed to it, and I don't think it would be a good thing to abandon what you have set yourself as a target when you are not able to achieve it. I think that would be the wrong time to abandon your. However, the Minister did indicate, and we are committed to the Minister's commitment also to allowing an engagement on this, so that we can have a debate whether going forward this would continue to be relevant. As you would know, there always would be an anchor of monetary policy. We came from a history where monetary policy was anchored on the exchange rate, and we all know what we came up with from that situation. So if there are people that think that should be revisited, we're quite happy to engage with that. The other one Minister is said I must look at is how does this TBPS speak to our manifesto? Members would know that the five priorities in our manifesto have since been translated into our medium-term strategic framework, which addresses the issues which the Minister actually went back to, I think, more than twice in his speech, because he wanted to remind us how committed we are to those objectives of promoting the creation of employment through a strong economy, the issue of the focus on education, on health, on rural development, and fighting crime and corruption. So this manifest, this MTBPS speaks directly to those areas, as you would see in a number of areas. The issue of counter-cyclical fiscal policy, how it addresses the developmental state. If the honourable member goes to page 9 of the statement itself, as she herself referred us to, it clearly states what the benefits of the counter-cyclical policy are, because it actually is meant to reduce the occurrence of the boom bust cycles in supporting a competitive exchange rate. We have adopted this counter-cyclical fiscal policy also to ensure that spending and tax decisions that are made when the economy is strong are still affordable also when the economy weakens. I'm actually reading directly from the MTBPS. If the member could just also refer to that. So for a developmental state, that's precisely the intervention that the state would make in order to protect its citizens from the vagaries of the economy that that can turn quite ugly. Minister, I don't know whether I've left anything, but that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Let me go back to some of the questions that still remain. The first is skills development, and all we can say is that we agree with the honourable member that raises that question. And we need to give Mr. Ndumane an opportunity to get his new higher education department going, where this responsibility now lodges. And I'm sure that his energy and passion will begin to give us some results. I think there's a lot of good work happening, but we don't quite see all of the results. But there are also too many silos in our system. And if we get rid of some of those silos and get better focus. There's a lot of money in this whole area of skills development, but it needs to be utilized in a much better way. You then raise a very sensitive question around SACU and the interim IPA, South Africa not having signed, others having signed. This has been a subject of engagement when SACU ministers of trade and finance have met, and I'm happy to say that there's a better understanding about how we need to approach this. There's also an understanding between South Africa and the EU that as we approach the final EPAS, that we will try to solve some of the shortcomings that led to this particular problem. So for now, I think we need to give that process a chance and let the diplomatic and political processes and the processes of negotiation at a trade level an opportunity to sort itself out. On triple P's, whether this is the best way, we don't think it's the best way, we think it's one way. And that the state doesn't always have either all the skills or all the capital that is often required to do the things that we need to do. And triple P's, when used with appropriate judgment and discretion, do have a way of complementing the state's efforts and reinforcing our ability to actually deliver. They don't apply and should not apply on a universal basis anyway. It's now been proven over the last 10 years that PPPs, if used incorrectly in, for example, municipal utilities, can cause immense problems. I can remember difficulties in Chile and Argentina, for example, where water was, inverted commas, privatized and electricity was privatized. The poor had no access to those services, and that caused immense havoc. And I think the PPPs have moved beyond that point, fortunately, in the current circumstances as well. I think, Chair, we've now handled all of the questions.
Thank you. How many people want to speak? Yeah. Then I'm going to request that we take a 10-minute break, because tea is ready. When you come back, I'll take your hands. You are quite many. And some of the follow-up questions you came during tea time, talk to the minister. so that they really respond to that. No, I know Ravi. That's it.
I think what is very interesting, and I agree with you, I think we find ourselves in a very serious recession at the moment. I think unemployment is alarmingly of a high proportion. I think you mentioned in one of the policy statements that something like 45% of the age group between 20 and 35 are at the moment are unemployed. Now, Chairman, on page 37, I think it's mentioned that 600,000 people, there were 600,000 new entrants into the social budget, or the social grant system and so forth. My question to the Honourable Minister, this is an alarmingly high figure of people. How long will we be able to sustain this particular social grant system? Because it places a burden. If there's no economic growth or limited economic growth, will we be able to sustain this particular system? And then, Chairman, on page, I think 51, the revised expenditure estimates, you mentioned quite a number of figures there, rollovers, but I don't see anything that relates to welfare. Will the Minister be able to elaborate upon that? And then on exchange controls, Chairman, the Minister, you said, and we welcome that. I think it's especially in trying times such as this, if you can ease exchange controls, it shows that there's tremendous confidence in the South African rand as a currency. But Chairman, I'd like to know if the Minister can tell us, you mentioned there, retain controls for funding portfolio investment, property investments to curb excessive speculation. Is it possible to give us more clarity? How will we be able to restrict or investment into real estate? And I'd like you to elaborate upon foreign investment in this country. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you.
Honourable Lees and Honourable Makubule, can you please raise your hands down this side? Let's first take this side. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Forgive my voice, I hope I make myself audible and understandable. So, Minister, thank you very much for all what you've presented to us. I think you've done an excellent job given the circumstances under which you find yourself, both economically and politically. What I don't see, and perhaps not as well versed as I should be, is any great effort to attract foreign investment. And if you could put me right on that, I'd appreciate that. And then you, in passing, talked about the NHI and that there are no numbers yet. What is your view, your feeling about the cost of that exercise and what effect it may or may not have on future years' budget, given that the state's intention is to introduce that as early as next year, and here we now talking about the budget for those years, coming years. And indeed, you're right, political point scoring is sometimes counterproductive. But unfortunately, Mr. Minister, we have a history of ruling party cadre deployment which has made it very difficult now to deal with corruption and transparency. And so, yes, indeed, it requires all of us to be committed to this, and I believe that all of us in this room are committed to it. But it does require an additional commitment from the ruling party to deal with these issues, particularly in municipalities. This is where I come from very recently, where tender transparency just does not exist, as a simple example, which could be stopped overnight. And I know that this is a process, it's a mindset, you're absolutely right about that. But there are a couple of things that could be done fairly quickly, which would send a very strong message, I think, to those people. Mr. Minister, you've clearly indicated first that the land bank's under control. I'm not sure what influence you may or may not have on Itala Bank. I know it's a provincial function, but I'm sure you have some influence there. And there's some serious events that have occurred in that bank over the last couple of years, and I would be interested to know whether you're involved and what action has been taken, where a number of MEC's wives have been given huge loans to buy farms and so on. So I'd be interested to hear your input on that. The matric or the school leaver voucher is a great idea. I think it emanates possibly from another party, but that's great if it's being implemented. We're happy with that. A question for the Staff Commissioner. You know, your system is fantastic, and we chatted a week or two ago, and one of the points I wanted to make then, that you've now raised it yourself in terms of third-party verifications of undisclosed income. One of the difficulties taxpayers have is when they get your letter, you refuse, or your organization refuse to declare or disclose to the taxpayer what the undisclosed information is. And very often these poor taxpayers just have no idea. They say, well, here's a letter, but I don't know what I haven't disclosed. And so it makes it very difficult. I think there should be more transparency and say, listen, chap, you earned 20,000 rand interest from ATSA Bank and you haven't told us. Now you're in trouble. Give us the information or whatever. But I find it very difficult that the SARS have the information, write a letter to the taxpayer, and then don't say what it is exactly they're looking for. They just say, you haven't declared everything, now declare everything. And I'm sure it is, because you're looking at ATSA, but the fellow's got something down here in a Swiss bank account, and he suddenly thinks you might have that. But it does make life difficult. Mr. Chairman, my apologies for entering into a little tete-a-tete here. Chairman, the question of the wage bill is indeed an important one, or the salaries and wages, and the Minister has indicated that one needs value for money. But the word caretaker in our country, generally speaking, and in many state departments, is pretty poor. Now, as an MP, I spend a lot of time when I'm in my constituency visiting state institutions. I've been to hospitals, police stations, and social welfare departments, home affairs, all in the last 2 months. And there's a huge disparity in home affairs in Newcastle, for instance. The work ethic is fantastic. I mean, I was bowled over. But social welfare in Otsizweni is appalling. So there needs to be a carrot and stick approach here. There are some really top class public servants out there. So we must be careful about being too generalised about this work ethic, but it is generally poor, I'm afraid. Chairman, I think that I've got a long list here. I'm not going to ask any more questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. First of all, I would like the Honourable Bob Mokwe, and then after you, Honourable Ramasagan. But our request is that the Minister is trying to save, because I'm trying to encourage people to save on funds. Maybe let's save on time this as well. So the question that has already been raised, please, let's not emphasize too much on it. Please,
thanks, Chair. I would like to take this opportunity to align myself also with those who concerned as the Minister on his budget speech. My question is on page 2 of your medium-term budget policy statement. It was indicated that from 1980 to 2002, South Africa experienced a rising of unemployment. This led to the millions of people or mother citizens in South Africa to struggle about poverty, hunger, frustration, and marginalization. And that coupled with this imbalances of man economy, you find that the economy cannot sustain the imbalances between the savings and the investment, and between earnings and consumption, and between rich and poor, it couldn't. And then can the minister say that, okay, since we have seen the rising of unemployment, is there anything which we are putting in place in order to alleviate? We cannot say eradicate, but to alleviate and to get the better standard of living in South Africa. Can the minister say, as we said yesterday, say that, yes, we can? Can you repeat the statement in telling the South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just a small question. That on the slide 11, the first bullet in the section that deals with the supporting recovery to achieve rapid growth, there is this first bullet that speaks about, raises four issues about labor intensive, and of course improving training, education, and lowering costs for hiring. I just want to understand the slides, I mean that paragraph a little bit more clearer, because it's really a loaded paragraph which I don't understand. If you can decode it, are we in terms of lowering costs for hiring, what are we actually referring to? Is it the return to the old discussion about a two-tier system, or what are we really referring to here? And so I just want to understand, just if we decode that particular slide. And secondly, I think the issue about infrastructure, massive infrastructure investment in terms of cushioning the challenge of economy, I think that we agree with. But I just want to understand, Minister, you talk about the 3.2 growth in the outer year. And in another slide, you make reference to the massive injection of the World Cup FIFA, which has been in terms of the cushioning of the economy. In the outer year, in this infrastructure, in massive infrastructure investment, in terms of the estimate of the outer year, are we going to see real that infrastructure investment as you're suggesting here? Is that estimate of 3.2 in real, given the program that is in the pipeline, is in terms of already that we have? I just want to understand the relative. And in terms of the 3.2 relative, in terms of job creation, creating more jobs in terms of that growth, is that estimation the correct one? Thank you.
Comrade Khare Blom and Whip, we want to have a second fight. No, before you, Comrade Nsisi, after Comrade Khare Blom, and you'll be the last.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Unyamba, the plan. When I was calling your boss,
Thanks, Chair. For me, it's just a short question in terms of the contingency reserve plan. It has been once said in the presidential address that those that will be losing work in terms of retrenchment and other plans in the, particularly in the private sector, how are they catered in this budget for training purposes? That's why I'm asking about the contingency plan that is there for them. How is it being catered into this budget? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I congratulate the minister because for the best.
Minister, I want this question clarified.
Oh, I'm saying if people could just say their names because it's hard to see from here. So, Chair, when you introduce them, if you could just say the names clearly so we can respond to the honourable member.
Comrade Chake.
My name is Comrade Chake. I want to join the people who congratulated the minister because now it seems the future is bright and there is going to be improvement in the people's lives. My question is on page 8 on commodity price support, the recovery. On bullet 2 says, where it talks about gold, platinum, it says oil is up by 62. I would like to know from the minister, what are his projections beyond January 2000? Do you see oil coming up or going down because we are already being killed by this petrol hikes that are happening? And I would like to know that with regard to oil as a product of oil that we use, cooking oil that we use in the household, does it mean it's going to increase too? And I'm wondering how we're going to go on making chips for our children and the said cakes if the cooking oil goes up, because it's one of the products that are being very used within the household. The question that I was going to ask again is on page 12, supporting the recovery and achieving more rapid growth. But I think Comrade Ramatakane has already answered that question, because I would say if there's going to be a boost in job creation, one expects that there's going to be a lot of vacancies and there's going to be a high rate in hiring. But now at the end there is that statement that says is going to be lowering the cost of hiring. I want clarity between the two. Thank you.
Honourable Comrade Mashiko.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Mashiko. My question is going to be on based on local government, where we know that we have we can form partnership, a very fruitful partnership with public and private partnership. But somewhere there's a disjuncture where when you look, you see that the private sector is involved, but somehow, maybe because of lack of trust between the two, there's nowhere where these two match. I would like to know whether there's any measures in place, especially from the department, where we could say now these are the tools that are going to be used to make sure that the synergy between the two sectors and we are able to observe what they're doing. We are able to see that the private sector has brought such a person into this company for whatever way where they could assist the development of the public sector in with the intention of service delivery. We see that private sector is assisting in this way, and there's that joint working relationship between the two, because I think with our recession and other things that are going to constrain service delivery, we need proper unity between the two sectors. I would just like to know what is on the books from the department, from the National Treasury, so that we could say when we go out there, we are able to talk to our local government and others and say, this is what is happening, this is where we can assist. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I'll put on my agriculture hat, and that is that I want to ask the Minister a question about the wheat export, and also page 25 in this document about the Doha Agreement. Where are we now with the Doha Agreement? I think that there's still discrimination about or against the farmers of this country or the producers of developing countries. And I think I want to hear what is the situation. Is it still on the agenda of the Ministers of Finance, and where are we now with the Doha Agreement? Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade. Comrade Sandrine, did you have your hand up there? Oh, you covered. Okay. That's progressive. Comrade Matthews.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Yeah, Comrade Chair. Mm. I just wanted to check the extent to which South African companies in particular. I wanted to check the extent to which our companies contribute also to the increase or negative consequences of inflation. Most in particular, when you look at staple food, you know, your millionaire, your bread and your milk, because this collusion by these companies to a large extent, I think they inflated their prices. But now the issue is also with respect to the competition board, once it acts on these particular companies. The punitive measures which are meted out on these companies. These companies seems like, you know, they are usually expecting it, and as a result, it seems like they actually budget for this eventuality. Now I'm saying to the minister, would these measures not be reviewed? Because it seems like the fines is something which is not beyond these companies. And then the other thing is the very fines. I know they revert to the fiscals, but is it possible to utilize these fines for specific, you know, delivery programs, like, I mean, for instance, in health, you could be building clinics with these fines that accrue from the fines of this company. I thank you, Shepard.
Yes, thank you, Comrade. Comrade says, Peter, the whip.
Thank you, Shepard. All you have introduced me already. Shepard, the African National Congress, in its 52nd National Conference, resolved, among other things, to deal with inequalities in the health sector. And they resolved to establish a national health insurance system to deal with those inequalities. And I was hoping that the policy statement will at least indicate as to how this government is planning to phase in that project. I don't know whether it's an omission from the minister or it was deliberate for them not to do so.
Well, it looks like Minister everyone has raised the question. We are at your, in your hand. Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Abhi raised the question about sustainability of social grants, and this links to all the questions about employment that several other honourable members have raised as well. We are not building a welfare state in South Africa, as far as the government is concerned. We are building a state which is able to create an environment where entrepreneurs can create jobs, where workers can work in dignity, where families can live in decency. And like in any other society, we will have a section of our community that is not going to be able to support itself for various reasons. And we're, I think, very fortunate compared to most developing countries that we have many significant elements of a fairly sound social security system, which needs to be rationalized, developed, coherent, and taken further. And so ultimately we want a balance between welfare and work. And that's what we are, that's what the whole job creation debate is about. And what many of these slides are saying, and one of our colleagues referred us to page 2, which says we haven't done well for a long time as a country in terms of creating jobs. And that's true. So the big challenge which the MTBP has put forward in a speculative way, if you like, at the moment for discussion and debate is how do we intend to do things differently from this point onwards? And that's the concept of the growth path, if you like, that we are talking about. What will we do in a different way? How will we grow the economy differently? If we do more of the same, we're not going to do any better, not in any substantial way. Nobody has an answer at this point in time. What we have are various commissions and studies, and we quote one of them in the speech and in the document, which is a commission headed by Professor Spence, which says that after looking at a number of countries that grew at 7% for a significant length of time, what did they do right? What are some of the things that they did which we could use as an inspiration, if you like, for ideas that are appropriate to the South African situation? Now, it's President Zuma's intention that this matter now be taken a lot more seriously and canvassed and debated a lot more seriously, and Chair, I imagine the committee would want to engage with these issues as well. And what the MTBPS does is that it puts in place, if you like, a bit of agitation, a number of thoughts, directs you to some of the studies that have been conducted, and says, let's put our heads together and ask what is appropriate in the South African context. So we would agree with you that we can't ignore this balance between welfare and work. But the key is how do we create that work for all of our people. All of the exchange control issues I'll ask the DG to deal with in a moment. Mr. Reed, the efforts to attract FDI, you know, officials of the Treasury and the Reserve Bank spend a fair amount of time meeting with investors, and will be doing so in a few weeks' time, and they do it 2 or 3 times a year. In order to provide direct answers, interface publicly and rather in person with the investor community, and give them insights into new developments and give them reassurances where that is appropriate. So that's one side. DPI has just set up a call center where investors could call if they have questions, so that there's one place they can get information from. SARS has similar facilities at the Large Business Center, where if you're unclear about tax laws and so on, you can come, we'll talk, we'll explain. There are a number of incentives in our system, but incentives are useful but also dangerous, because they constitute what others call a race to the bottom. You give somebody a corporate rate of 30%, Dr. George counters that and says 25%, and others will counter that, maybe on my right here, and say, no, we will charge 15. At the end, it's the company that benefits, it's the fiscus that suffers. And that's the race to the bottom that people actually talk about. So in South Africa, generally, we haven't been doing that kind of bidding. Sometimes we've lost investment. In one instance, I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a particular company in the textile industry willing to set up a plant, hire so many hundred people, etc. It went to a neighboring country, but 3 or 4 years later it collapsed. So it's good that we didn't take on that particular bid. A number of questions have been asked about the NHI. And I know that this is a major focus. I'm not the expert on the NHI. Dr. Masoleri is. And he has a very clear idea of how we will both elaborate a proper plan for the implementation of the NHI and its costing with Treasury and the Health Department, and at the same time improve our current health system in order to create the conditions for the NHI to actually work. So it requires two parallel and joined processes. The one which elaborates what it means to implement NHI and where the costs are coming from, and the second is to ensure that we improve the current system and get it to work better so that NHI has a system to work on ultimately. So we're not ducking this issue, but all we're saying is that we're not ready at this stage as government to go much further. And I hope that at some stage perhaps the committee invites Dr. Masoleri to talk to you directly and tell you how he intends to take this further. The Treasury is already working with the Health Department and beginning to understand what the implications are. Remember also that the state wants to rationalize and take further our social security system. That's been a process that's been going on for about 3 or 4 years now. Now, both of these will impose a cost on the state. And we've got to bring all of these costs on the table. And then government has to decide how it will prioritize each of these and what the fiscal affordability is and how it will phase it in and so on. So I can assure the honorable members, either from this side of the room or that side of the room, that there is work going on, but we are not in a position to put any data on the table because it's premature to actually do that. And I repeat my point that the best person to address this is Dr. Masoleri. And if you invite him, I'm sure he will share his thoughts with you. You also talk about a commitment from the ruling party in respect of cadre deployment and financial management. The ruling party itself is actually admitting that, for example, financial management is not working in many municipalities and many provincial governments. The president has met with premiers. The president has met with premiers and finance MEPs. The president has directly met with the heads of municipalities, and both administrative and political. That was just last week. And what's the object of all of these meetings? It is beginning to understand and get an engagement going which says we can't carry on as we are. We can't, for example, not pay bills to the tune of 10 billion rand in provinces. We can't overspend by 6 billion rand in provinces, because you are then imposing a cost on the following year. And many people in the provinces are learning that as the new administrations take over. Similarly, in some instances, municipalities have genuine difficulties, and others they don't. Revenue collection in municipalities falls significantly short. So there are billions of rands that are being owed, and there are billions of rands that are being owed by people who can in fact afford to pay. So, whilst we've got some elements, as the Commissioner was pointing out earlier, of payment of tax going in South Africa, payment of all of what is due to the state still has some way to go. So, that's a challenge that, as government, we are very aware of. But let me invite Mr. Brown, before he falls asleep, to say a few words in this regard.
And I was falling asleep now. Now, I mean, the debt own is basically known, but the last chunk of the debt we're busy starting to categorize it. But one problem that we've identified, for example, is provinces and national governments owe municipalities, for example, 2.4 billion. Now, you know, part of the problem there is both ways, where bills have been issued, but national and provincial governments didn't respond. But in some cases, the billing systems of municipalities are failing themselves to be able to issue these bills on time. So these are the issues that we are looking into and trying to resolve the specific issues around the billing systems that the Finance Minister.
On SARS, perhaps the Commissioner wants to say a few words.
Yes, that's
good. Good. A cup of tea usually helps in South Africa. It solved many problems for us. Itala Bank is not a national government responsibility, but we share your concern that whatever wrong is happening must A, stop, and B, brought to book. I think we need to say a little louder what you said about some government departments do work well. And I'd like you to, as a test, you know, try out some of our bigger companies and phone them at their call centers and see what kind of service you get. And call them at their one office in one town and another office in another town and see what service you get there as well. So, bottom line is that running a generally good service in a large multi-locational enterprise is a tough job, whether in the private sector or public sector. But that doesn't mean that we need to try harder to get the consistency going, so we agree with you fully. DG, you want to address some of those issues so that I can have a bit of a rest?
Thanks, Minister. So it was the issue of exchange control that you said I must deal with. Just to say that we had had to have a further process of exchange control relaxation as our contribution to improving the environment of business and lowering the cost of doing business in South Africa. There are things that are in exchange controls which do not belong there. There are things in there which correctly should be in prudential regulations. As Minister was saying, we are engaged in discussions in the G20 about what are the steps that should be taken by national authorities in the form of regulation that would protect economies from external vulnerabilities, and some of that stuff we have in exchange control, they shouldn't be there. The specific question that was asked was with respect to dealing with the real estate speculation and what that means. What we currently have had in the exchange control regulation, which we have decided to retain, is that when foreigners buy real estate in South Africa, they should buy it with cash, because what would have happened, as it we have seen it elsewhere, is that they would enter your market, domestic market, borrow money from your local bank, buy the property, and then when they can't service the thing, they just walk away, and then you are stuck with the property. You can't enforce. You can't enforce that. It's that kind of speculative activity that we would like to stop. With respect to the portfolio investors, you are aware that we have got a limit in terms of how much portfolio investors, South African fund managers, can actually invest offshore. Those are done for a reason. It meant to protect South African investors, and we are basically trying to apply what we call a prudential person rule. When the fund managers go and they invest there, the question that we are insisting they should have in their policies is, what would a prudent person have invested in? Because what we have seen has been that some of the investors had driven out to go and invest offshore, and the quest was just to get out of the country rather than to enhance the returns of their investor base, with consequences. I'm aware of a pension fund which suffered a double whammy in 2002, which the fund managers advised that they should be investing in European stocks, and the truth of the matter was that there wasn't much value in there. The value had to do with any perceived possibility of the rent depreciating. What eventually happened was that actually not only did the rent appreciate, European stocks took a plunge and pensioners were actually left seriously out of money. It's those kinds of things that by having this prudential regulation, we are attempting to protect South African investors against those kinds of things.
I'm going to activate the back benches from Sadra onwards, and they will take on a number of the questions that the honourable members have asked. But we'll come back to Mr. Makubera if we can at some stage.
Thank you, Minister. I'll just address the question on the oil price assumption. Obviously, the oil price has been extremely volatile in recent years. Last year it peaked at about $140 a barrel. Earlier this year it was down at $40 a barrel, and since then it's doubled to its current level at $77 a barrel. So it really is a hugely moving target and a difficult one to make projections on. But what we have is we sort of project the average quarterly level and then get to an average annual level. In 2008, the average annual level was just below $100 a barrel. For this year, we estimate it will be around $60 a barrel, which is a bit lower than its current level because obviously we started the year at a very low level. And then over the medium term, we have it rising gradually to around $75 average next year, $82 in 2011, and just below $90 in 2012. So unfortunately, along with stronger global growth and the recovery in global demand, one also sort of to have a consistent story needs to take into consideration that demand for oil will also rise. As to the cooking oil, that is a function of sunflower seeds, I believe. I'm not sure what the current actual CPI level is, but I would imagine that after reaching very, very high levels last year, the rate of inflation in cooking oil has come down, but I agree with you, it is still very high.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few questions. The first is that the 2.4 billion rand is for the training layoff levy scheme, which is a contribution towards supporting workers or firms to avoid retrenchments but to provide a training allowance, is being funded out of the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the Skills Levy Fund, the CETAs, and so is not on the main budget. It is money funded out of public resources, but it's broadly money that the UIF and the CETAs have. And so there's 2.4 billion rand set aside there. We've not had to adjust the social welfare budget for 2009-10. There's sufficient amounts of money in the present budget to enable the start of the phasing in of the extension of the child support grant, but we would have to add money in the three outer years to that. So that's why there's no revised estimate on page 51 of the document. Attempting to deal with the lowering the costs of hiring, one of the proposals, and again these are just ideas, one of the ideas that's contained in the document is the idea of subsidizing the social insurance contributions of workers. So for example, if I'm an employee and I have to pay UIF, or the firm has to pay UIF or skills levy for me, if we subsidize that for poor workers, we might be lowering the costs of employment. So that's one of the ideas there, to help subsidize the social insurance contributions, such as unemployment insurance contributions, for low-income workers. Let me see if there's anything else there that needs to be dealt with. The issue raised about fines and the Competition Commission. Firstly, I think we fully agree that one of the reasons why South Africa has uncompetitive markets is because we have uncompetitive product markets, that there's too much collusion in some sectors, there's a lack of competition in some sectors.
Take it easy. Explain what you mean by an uncompetitive product market.
Sure, Minister.
In simple English.
Sure. In some industries, in some markets, there are just too few players, and therefore, and as has been demonstrated through legal processes in some industry, these players, instead of competing as you're supposed to do to bring prices down and deliver better services, these players get together and they set prices at quite a high level, and they say, you know, you operate in that part of Johannesburg, I'll operate here. We'll both charge a high price, but let's not really compete. The OECD report into the South African economy details this as listed this as one of the reasons why South Africa is uncompetitive. And I think the Competition Commission and the Department of Trade and Industry is doing a good job in trying to reduce the occurrence of collusion or cartels. Whether the funds can be used for specific purposes, at the moment the money flows into the National Revenue Fund, and so it's then allocated as part of the general budget process. We've been reluctant to earmark these fines for any specific purpose because of the volatility of the fines. So let's assume that we earmark it for a school nutrition program or a clinic building program. In one year you might have a lot of money, in another year you might not have any money. And therefore, we think for those kinds of key priorities, providing certainty is better. Of course, we do take the point that you've made and has been made repeatedly in the media, is that the public want to feel as though they're getting a benefit from the fine, for example, on a bread company. And so shouldn't we try and do something with this money that helps lower the cost of food? And I think that we're willing to engage, we're willing to listen to ideas about how we can achieve that objective without providing uncertainty in the budgets for key spending programs. Thank you, Minister.
See, you are asking for in the street now. Honourable Member Mashiko referred to Triple P. We perhaps Andrew Donaldson should address that, at least you hear his voice.
All right. I mean, the question was, you know, about alignment of the public and private sectors, which is a very interesting issue, not just in our context, but worldwide. When I studied economics 30 years ago, the textbooks told stories about how the economy can be analyzed, can be understood as consisting of firms that compete with each other in the private sector and governments that provide other services through departments that are managed in the way in which we manage them, executive authority and ministers, decision-making that is quite hierarchical. They don't compete. You don't try to have duplication of government agencies competing with each other. You actually try not to do that. You try to have simple, direct, what is called economies of scale in the production of public services. The idea, in other words, that we grew up with is that the world divides into competitive firms and government services. And some things are done in one part of the economy and other things are done in the other. And increasingly we understand that it's not so simple. There are industries in which it is the combined activities of both businesses and government that really count. And of course there are industries in which there are very considerable reasons for government to regulate, to intervene, to set standards, to perhaps co-finance activities, and in industries like our health sector, really you can't think of it as either a government or a private sector activity. It is the interaction between what government does and what businesses do, what the private sector does, that in the end is the has to be taken into account in understanding how services are provided. So the whole world is having to rethink how public and private sector interact with each other, and in some ways has to rethink the economics of regulation, coordination, cooperation, contracting between the public and the private sectors.
Now, our what when we talk about public-private partnerships in the Public Finance Management Act, and we have a unit in the Treasury that regulates these activities, we're talking about very specific kinds of long-term partnerships. These are contracts in which government decides that it wants not just to procure a service, buy something off the shelf, but contract for a long-term relationship with a private service provider. And that's one kind of partnership. It takes a lot of time to negotiate. It is done through a procurement process. It involves quite strict rules of first publishing the proposals that government wants to receive from the private sector, and then adjudicating those bids, and then negotiating long-term service agreements. For example, for the building of a hospital and its equipping and its maintenance services over 15 or 20 years, or in the case of some of our toll roads, not just the construction of the road, but also the maintenance of that road over a 20-year period. And as traffic increases, so in those contracts, the business that has the concession agreement is obliged to build another lane or extend the highway or add another bridge when traffic reaches certain volumes. So that kind of public-private partnership requires very detailed contracting. It's an extension of an improvement of procurement. It puts more work into the procurement process. But I think what the question is pointing to is that there is another category of partnership that is broader, that is about working with NGOs, that is about ensuring that perhaps when a retail development happens in a township, that there should be attention to community services, perhaps even an arrangement with the local welfare office that there should be facilities, that there should be a convenient co-location, we call it, of business opportunities with public services, a library, access to internet facilities, and so on. And we are beginning to develop that kind of partnership. The particular program that the Treasury has initiated that does that is the Neighbourhood Development Program grant, which provides funding to municipalities. There are about 90 projects in this portfolio underway, in which funding goes to municipalities to enable municipalities to put the public infrastructure in place that is accompanied by business investment. And so the township development projects that are funded through that program are aimed both at bringing in business opportunities but also co-locating public services with them. And I think developing library facilities is a good example of how that can be done as shopping centres and retail facilities are developed. So there's an example of broadening the kind of alignment between public and private activity through a specific infrastructure development activity. I think if one moves into the whole area of health systems development that Minister Matsuledi is working on currently, alongside the health insurance arrangement, sharing of facilities and sharing of infrastructure and sharing responsibility for maintenance of hospitals becomes another category of partnership that will contribute to making NHI affordable over time. So I think what I'm saying, Minister, is there is a lot of complexity to the relationships between the public and private sectors. It's not just something that we're learning to do. In many ways, these are challenges that other governments in the whole world is dealing with, particularly in community development, housing, and health services. And we're learning something about the limitations of economics and how to think about things differently as we deal with these issues.
If you kept quiet, you wouldn't have let her hold on that. Thank you. I think there's just one last question remaining, Chair. It's from Mr. Krokum about Doha. Doha is the brief of the Minister of Trade and Industry. There are complex processes going on. As you know, it's been going on for 8 years now. There were meetings in India about 3 months, 2 months ago. There's another meeting I think he's gone to in Egypt. So there's any amount of talking that's happening. But trade negotiations are about what are you going to give up and what am I going to give up, and what access do we give one another to each of our markets and economies. And generally still the bigger economies are not willing to give too much. We're also confronted by sometimes South Africa's old definition as a developed country during what they call the Uruguay round, and that places us in some difficulties about what kind of commitments we are required to put on the table. So I don't think you're going to see any answers in the next 6 months, for a start. There has been some sort of giving and taking in the last few months, but nothing which leads to any extraordinary and sudden agreement around the table. So finally, Chair, from our side, I think there's some messages that are coming through in all the debates that we've had so far. It's in government, like elsewhere, we've got to start doing certain basic things right. Let's run our schools properly, let's run our departments properly, let's run our clinics properly, and do the basic things well. And if we do the basic things well, the rest will begin to come. And sometimes we focus on the fancy stuff rather than getting the basics right. And perhaps Parliament and committees need to look at what constitutes the basics in respect of any particular department, and are they doing that well, apart from the fancy stuff that we want to do. The second is to acknowledge, as some of the colleagues have been saying, that there are many things that do work, and let's start acknowledging them. We're not in a hopeless, failed state. We're far from it. We have a reasonably strong state. We have a capable state. Yes, it has deficiencies, but there are many things that work. And let's celebrate those things that work, and let's build on the positive elements. Otherwise, we'll really become the victims of depression, and all be running to psychiatrists for antidepressants. I know something about that because I used to dispense those prescriptions at one stage. As Andrew Donaldson said, and we've been saying this repeatedly, and the President above all is saying, this is a different era we're entering. If you use old formulae to start looking at the era that is beginning to commence now, we aren't going to find solutions. And so what's happening is a lot of our interlocutors, let me put it politely, are still stuck in a particular mode and a particular way of looking at life and understanding the economy. We've got to shift that and begin to open ourselves up. And you've had an excellent example given to you by Andrew Donaldson of how the relationship between public, private and civil society is being reconfigured, even in our own country. And unless we can tune in to those new developments, we aren't going to be able to make a success of what we actually have to do. And we'll be fighting with one another or critiquing one another on the wrong basis, because we're not asking the right questions amongst ourselves. We'll be satisfying ourselves in terms of making the right noises, but we won't be getting anywhere in terms of a meaningful engagement on the key issues that confront our country. And in the spirit of partnership that was just mentioned, and what I indicated earlier on, let's find more things we can agree on. We are living in South Africa. I know this place is called Parliament, and we're supposed to have political contestation, but I don't think that stops us from agreeing on certain things. And saying that this committee agrees, corruption is bad, savings is good, not wasting money is excellent, asking for value for money is something that all of us agree on. So if I may, it's not my job, but if I may, I'd like to throw that challenge onto your lap and say it'll be great if we can get that kind of consensus going. And then lastly, the point that Mr. Naidoo made about product competitiveness. These are the second tier, deeper issues that we need to start getting into and understanding the structure of the South African economy. There are several members who are worried on both sides of the house, and understandably and correctly, about where is employment going to come from. So why don't we ask ourselves serious questions about what is it that blocks these things? And clearly, whether it's the price of cooking oil or anything else, as one of our colleagues mentioned, the issue of competition, which then reduces prices, is a serious challenge in South Africa. We also had one of our colleagues talking about small businesses, but lots of our business is dominated by big businesses. So where do you create the space for small businesses? And both as the private sector and as the public sector, we need to do a lot about that. So, Chairs, thank you very much for this engagement and for the questions and for the opportunity to clarify issues with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. I was watching as everyone was responding. You know, when Mr. Donaldson responded, you should have given him a little bit of time. He had some time for him. I think he thought about his other previous life. You got a lot of support. We are close now. Because I think you can just exchange cards with him. People are going to write exams with a certain So you help. But thank you very much, Minister. I think that we have come to the end of this first session. And I would like Chairperson Pamadita to close before we go to the next one.
Okay.
The next one, which we are really going to squeeze, and I'm not sure if I'm very happy about that, is the adjustment. But I think that a lot has been covered broadly on this matter.
Let's take you through it very quickly. Mr. Naidu will do that.
Sure.
Thank you. The 2009 Adjustments Appropriation Bill deals with the changes in this fiscal year to the appropriations. Things that can go in the Adjustments Appropriation Bill, there's several categories and I'll run through them. This, what you're seeing there is the summary of all the adjustments. So let me take you slowly through these numbers. The 429 billion rand on the left is what was the main appropriation bill that was tabled in Parliament in February. And then the 302 billion below that is direct charges against, excuse me, the National Revenue Fund. That 302 billion includes the provincial equitable share, which is the largest direct charge, followed by debt interest costs and the remuneration of public office bearers, judges and magistrates. Is the third category of direct charges. That gives us a subtotal of 732.6 billion rand that we budgeted to spend. We then set aside a contingency reserve of 6 billion, and so we tabled in Parliament a spending envelope of 738.6 billion. That's what we did in February. This time, we're adding to the spending, we're adding 1.5 billion rand as a result of rollovers, money that was unspent last year that we're rolling over into this fiscal year, mainly for infrastructure projects, and I'll go through one or two of the details. The Public Finance Management Act enables us to budget for what's called unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure, expenditure that we could not anticipate at the time of the budget, such as the creation of new departments or natural disasters, etc., etc. At national level, the salary adjustments, the fact that the salary increases were higher than budgeted, will cost us about 3 billion rand. And then there's a series of other unallocated amounts that were announced at the time of the budget but not appropriated. And there's two specific amounts there, 1 billion rand for the land bank and 114.5 million rand for the community works program, which is a key element of the public works program. There's a small fire function shift from the Kwakwa National Park to national government, and then the self-financing expenditure. This is, for example, if the Defence Force sells a plane, the money flows into the revenue fund, and then we have to appropriate it back to them. Let's go on. Next slide. Let me run through the unforeseen and unavoidable expenditure quickly. The largest item is 12 billion rand for higher salaries, both as a result of higher general salary increases, but also occupation-specific dispensation adjustments that were higher than budgeted. Of that 12 billion, 3 billion goes to national and 9 billion goes to provinces. Public Works Department gets 150 million rand for new accommodation, office and residential accommodation for ministers and deputy ministers. And as part of the continued devolution of the property rights functions
that used to sit with National Public Works is now being devolved to provinces. The minister mentioned the workbooks. There's a first provision for the workbooks in this fiscal year. There's some money to deal with the for costs that have already incurred on the H1N1 flu pandemic. And I guess the largest, after the personnel adjustment, the largest adjustment is for the increased take up of the HIV and AIDS treatment programs, 900 million rand. The minister mentioned the 200 million rand for the SABC, which is a liquidity requirement, and it's to deal with the emergency financial difficulty that the SABC is in. From the 560 odd million rand for new ministers and departments, 250 million goes to rural development, and mainly for the pilot project in Kiani that Minister Nkwinti is overseeing, and then 509 million rand for the local government equitable share to compensate municipalities for the higher costs of providing free electricity. The 192 million rand for public enterprises is because Danel South Aerostructures did not fulfill a contractual obligation on the Airbus A400M project, and there's an indemnity claim of 192 million against the department. I mentioned both of those amounts, so let's move on. Rollovers, the largest rollover is on the municipal infrastructure grant. The second largest is on the construction of the Duwerp Dam. And let me stress that these are projects that are underway, they have commenced, but there's been either some slippage in the actual implementation, or in some cases services have been delivered but not yet paid for. And so that's why we've allowed these rollovers. The construction of the Pan African Parliament building and one or two IT projects in the Home Affairs field. I mentioned the self-financing expenditure. The largest is in actually in transport. Fees that are collected by e-natives are returned to the department. The second largest, the largest is in defense, and the second largest in transport, the sale of equipment. What's the other amount to return? The Mafisa. There used to be money in the agricultural debt account, and that is now flowing into the micro agricultural financial institution. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, the adjustments take into account anticipated underspending and savings this year. Savings is 1.5 billion rand in the defense vote, mainly as a result of delays in the Airbus A400M contract and contractual obligations, exchange rate changes to contractual obligations, and there's projected underspending of about 3 billion rand. That means that the total amount that we're planning to spend goes up from 738.6 billion to 752.5 billion, an increase of 14 billion rand over the original estimate tabled in February. Thank you. Section 6, clause 6 of the Adjustments Appropriation Bill deals with the new departments. I should spend 1 or 2 minutes on this because it is a confusing thing for members of parliament to manage. There's a process led by Minister Chabane and Minister Beloy to establish the new departments. Once the department is established, we create a vote. When the department is ready to receive the funds and the functions, then we will have a function shift. But in this, there are only one or two cases where the department is actually ready. In most cases, the department will only assume the funds and the functions from 1 April next year. And so the money is allocated to what's called the old or the parent department. So for example, the Department of Economic Development, the money is appropriated on the vote of the Department of Trade and Industry, but on 1 April they'll get their own, their vote is established, but it's an empty vote at the moment. But from 1 April the funds and the functions will be set out
in the budget, therefore. That's not a process that the Treasury controls or manages. That process of establishing departments, setting up their post-establishment, approving their program structures, that process is overseen by Minister Pillai. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister. So, colleagues, question? I know it's Honorable Swap on my left. Honorable Tage, Honorable Sugute, Madamin, and the Whip Federer.
I know that the other slot is now leaving because I'm talking. Chair, the presenter mentioned the question of, you know, municipal infrastructure grants, conditional grants, equitable shares, etc., and the rollovers. What is concerned, though, is that I believe a very large percentage of municipalities, when they receive these monies and these funds, use it for normal day-to-day running of the operations rather than using it for the purpose for which it was intended. And my question, therefore, is, you know, it looks as if it points to financial instability or financial, they're not financially viable, some of these municipalities, apart from the fact that some of them just run badly. But are there any other forms of income which is being looked at this particular point in time for municipalities to raise additional income?
Comrade Tucker?
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is on unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure on page 4. So there is money allocated for health, where N1H1 influenza pandemic is given as an example here, or as an issue. So I would like to know that since this infectious disease, you find out some are seasonal, whereby they rise in winter and they disappear in summer, or vice versa. So I would like to know, in diseases like N1H1, because it just came as a pandemic, what if it disappears? Is that money going to lie there, or can it be diverted to other communicable diseases such as say HIV and AIDS or cholera or any other communicable diseases? Thank you.
Comrade
Lee. Mine is on the establishment of the new department. I understand that the financing of the organizational structure and the actual setting up will be effective from the next financial year. So what I wanted to check, Chair, is in relation to the population of their organograms. So if the processes that relate to the population of such organograms are going to be started April next year, it will take almost 6 to 7 months towards the end of that financial year. Is there any mechanism that can be employed by Treasury to ensure that the processes that relate to population of organograms is began sooner than April next year? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The call, Chair. Mine is just a request to the Minister, if it's possible, regarding the rural development and the land reform. How possible it is to also include the unavoidable expenditure which was done by this department, maybe I need to relate a story where on the previous budget there were quite a number of the land claims and the department was unable to pay them, and as a result the department has signed the agreement with the land claimants, and because the government failed to pay at the right time, the interest gets accumulated. So then that sort of affects the budget allocated to the department. Now my request is it possible for the Treasury Minister to also look at this and see how do we then, because this was an unavoidable expenditure, we didn't have the money to cover for that. The main reason why I'm saying is because I chair the economic transformation at the KZN, and we had so much of the land claims and couldn't pay them. But right now, the outstanding interest to pay those the land payments is very high. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I want to agree with Mr. Naidu that Section 6 of the bill is very confusing. I read it yesterday, but I could not get answers from my head. I just want to ask the department chairperson to explain to us, like Mr. Naidu was saying, that currently, for example, let me illustrate my point by making an example, Chairperson. You have vote number 13, which is education. And in the current arrangement, you have basic and higher education. And if I got him correctly, the money goes to vote number 13, which is education. And you have these other two departments that are supposed to respond to issues relating to their mandate currently. I would like to get clarity as to how do they access funding or their funds from vote number 13, and then who becomes the accounting officer at the end of the day.
Okay. That's the other question from this side, Minister, it is related to, I see on the adjusted estimates book, no? On page Roman figure 10, I see about three responses to Western Cape disaster. You know, it's going to local government, it's its own, going to transport, going to agriculture. But I was listening to Mr. Naidu when he was talking about the contingency fund that we had, the 6 billion, it's still there, not touched. He's shaking, the minister is shaking, everyone is shaking his head. Trying to get the answer. But, okay, what is happening? Why is it that it's not consolidated, it's broken up like this? I think that's the. But lastly, it's fine, that time is okay.
So Mr. Brown will address the municipality's question, and Mr. Naidu will take on the other.
Thanks, Minister. We've got the Municipal Social Powers and Functions Act, and within that act, there's a clear process that's outlined for municipalities if they want to initiate the tax. Currently, the Treasury has put the ball basically in the municipality's court, and in our discussions with them, they will be coming forward with proposals on raising new taxes, for example, and it should be forthcoming in the next few months or so. In terms of that, yeah. So there is scope for them to step forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, let me deal with the new department's issue first, because it's confusing. And I my apologies for introducing a bill that is so confusing. It is a confusing situation. Let's take the education example as an example. Presently, you have the Department of Education, you have the Department of Basic Education, and you have the Department of Higher Education and Training. So at the moment, there are three departments. Duncan Hindu is the Director General of the Department of Education, so he's the accounting officer. He is the Acting Director General of the Department of Basic Education. And Ms. Mary Metcalf is the Director General of the Department of Higher Education and Training. So she is the accounting officer there. The money is flowing through the Department of Education vote. And Minister Beloy has put in place a process whereby ministers would come to an agreement on the protocols for the flow of funds. But the accounting officer is Mr. Hindle in this case. Right? Mr. Hindle, ministers Nzimande and Motshekga have to come to a written agreement, and the agreement is being facilitated by Minister Beloy on the protocols for how to spend money. But I can assure you that they can go ahead and spend money already. There is no restriction on them hiring staff or filling their organograms. So let's take the Department of Economic Development as an example. 29 million rand is voted on the Department of Trade and Industry's vote, but for the Department of Economic Development. They can access that funds immediately. They can use those amounts to start filling their organograms immediately. There's no restriction that they have to wait until 1 April. We've put this in place so that we don't hold up the process by which departments can build up capacity. And I hope that by next year this is all simplified, where there'll only be two departments of education, one for basic education and one for higher education and training, and what was called the old Department of Education would fall away. But it is complex at the moment. The Andrew will deal with the rural development land claims. The H1N1 pandemic, the money was used for three things. It was used for a awareness campaign. It was used to help track the numbers of people, and there were some administrative systems. But most of the money went into buying vaccines. And so those vaccines are there. Most of the money has been spent. The vaccines are kept in storage by the Department of Health. And if the virus re-emerges next year or even the following year, we will have those vaccines in storage. So it's basically the money has been used. The Western Cape disasters, the reason why they're not consolidated into one is mainly because they sit under the vote of the National Department, and for example, some of it is in the Department of Transport, some of it is in the Department of Agriculture. There's different responses to the disasters, depending on the kind of damage that was done. And so that's why it's not consolidated in a single disaster. If the money were to flow via the provincial equitable share, then the money would be consolidated. But in this case, the money sits under the vote of the National Department as well. Thanks.
In any case, some of the work that will be undertaken, for example, by the Western Cape, would be undertaken by the Department of Agriculture, for example. The municipal infrastructure damage that was caused by the flooding, for example, will be undertaken by local government. So it must then be reflected, basically, in local government. Some of the infrastructure is infrastructure that's, for example, owned by the Department of Transport. So the Department of Transport will have to resolve that particular problem there. Thanks.
We are certainly aware of big outstanding rural claims and the restitution program that has to be settled. The adjustments budget really isn't the place to do that. This is an ongoing program. The new minister, the new department are really asking quite searching questions about the approach to land restitution and the approach to costing the large rural claims that are outstanding, and so that program is under review, and we'll have to look at that for the purposes of next year's budget. What is included in this year in the adjustment is the additional money for rural development, which could be dealt with as an adjustment issue, and so the vote goes up from about 6.1 billion rand to about 6.4 billion. pending the review of the rural claims process and dealing with the difficulties that have arisen in some of the previous restitution projects, we simply weren't in a position to reach agreement on revised numbers in an adjustment.
Commissioner, you don't want us to go and lunch for your question. Okay. Quickly.
Up to me, is that Mr. Knight? When you say the money for N1H1 has already been used to buy the vaccines and they have been stored, is there any vaccine that has been produced to cure N1H1? Or which vaccine are you actually referring to?
What's the name of the drug? Tamiflu.
It's not a vaccine, it's the drug Tamiflu, which is an antiviral.
Our resident pharmacist has corrected me. It's not a vaccine. It's a Tamiflu.
I remember a little bit of pharmacy.
You cannot respond, Minister, but I think that maybe that's to say to members. I'm sure they are aware that as from next week, we'll be inviting now individual departments to account as individuals. But if the minister can respond, you're welcome to do so. But the Department of Health, that question can be put to the Department of Health if they're better placed to respond. Okay. With that, Minister, thank you very much. Minister, we're also contributing, you know, to saving, because we have agreed with the team that they are no longer going to come tomorrow to come and present the adjustment as we had agreed. But when we do hearing, at least they will assist the adjustment committees in terms of going through some more details now. With respect to the input. But on my side, thank you very much. We will allow Colette Mfamadi to close.
you always pass the buck. Thanks, Coach Chester and the Minister and your team. I think it was quite a very informative session that we've had with yourself and your team. And I want also to say to you, the things that you have tabled before Parliament, actually the budget itself, it's not just the responsibility of Treasury and the Executive to make it work. I think, by and large, Parliament has a very, very important role to make sure that you succeed in your work. Clearly, from where we are sitting, we now understand that this budget is within the context of a fiscal discipline. State expenditure for infrastructure is still there. We are going out into the market for borrowing, but borrowing for development, not for consumption. Thirdly, the area of revenue collection is quite critical. And I think Parliament has got a very, very important role to make sure that we assist you in that regard. It is the role of all parliamentary committees, not just ourselves in the finance division. So I thought we should just indicate to you that we fully understand what you're supposed to do. In terms of processes, I think as finance committees were geared up for the work before us, before the 12th of this month, of next month, so that we can be able to complete our work. Savings, that you have indicated to us in terms of the small book, there's one area that I think you should still look at. We are quite satisfied, let me say, personally, national savings, provincial savings. But there's an area that we have not touched, local government. The assumption may be that there's no money to be saved today. And I think there is still a lot of money that needs to be redirected in that area. Because savings is not about taking money from one program to the other. It's about what is government buying. That is also savings, value for money. And I think that area of local government needs to be looked at very, very closely. But I think relevant committees in Parliament should actually make sure that they assist in that regard. With those few words, would want to really thank you for making time and taking our questions very seriously and responding maximally, so that we can be able to work with you and work with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks once again to all of you. Thank you very much.